Early this morning, NASA Mission Control decided the weather in Florida was too unpredictable to allow a shuttle landing. Tomorrow, the shuttle has four more possible windows for return, two each at Cape Canaveral and at the backup site at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Until then, the shuttle crew gets to enjoy a few more spins around the Earth. Judging from the number of questions we got during our program on the space station last week on life aboard it, there's a lot of curiosity about life in microgravity. This is the time on Monday when we usually read from your emails. Today, we'll try to both answer your unaddressed email questions and take a few more of your calls on the biomedical aspects of space travel. If you have a question about how life in space affects the human body, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And with us to tell us more about the physiological challenges of an orbital lifestyle, we turn to Lewis Staudick. He's director of the BioServe Space Technology Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's nice to be here.
To begin with, we were joking around this morning about the early shutdown time for the shuttle's toilet before reentry. You can tell what kind of humor we have around here, but it turns out this is actually a big deal.
Well, yeah, I imagine that's probably going to be one of the priorities in staying up an extra day to get that back up and running again.
But hydration is a large factor in astronaut physiology, no?
It is. As it turns out, one of the first things that happens when astronauts go into space is fluid shift, basically the blood that normally pools down in our lower extremities, you know, flows downhill, so to speak, when mm-hmm. we stand or sit, ends up moving uphill or up, redistributing up into the head and chest region. And that causes the body to think that there's too much water and to get rid of it. And so what happens is astronauts will typically dehydrate by about a quart or so or a liter of blood volume. And that's not such a problem until they come back. And when they come back, without that extra blood volume, they're prone to dizziness and could even potentially pass out. So what they do is they rehydrate before they come back and drink about an extra liter and take some salt along with that to retain that water.
Just at the same time they shut down the toilet.
Exactly.
Well, that sort of answers the question we got from Paul Denning in Los Altos, California, who wrote to ask about seasickness. I guess we should call it space sickness. Can near-zero gravity wreak havoc on the inner ear?
You know, it's not so much wreaking havoc on the inner ear as much as it's probably the inner ear wreaking havoc on the rest of the body. Because once you get into space, all the normal cues that we're used to and that inner ear that's so sensitive to gravity and the direction that our heads are tilted, those cues are gone. And so we're looking with our eyes and we're feeling with our other senses, but the cues from the inner ear don't match up. And so that can lead to what's called space adaptation syndrome or sickness, and that happens to about half the astronauts.
And how long does it last?
You know, they get over it within 2 or 3 days, and there is medicine that they can take to help minimize the symptoms of that. And
Is it the same medicine we'd put on a patch behind our ear if we were going out to sea?
Pretty much. It's pretty much the same types of medicines that we would use here. And then they take some things to keep them from getting sleepy because some of those medicines would make us sleepy otherwise.
All right, let's get some callers in on the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, we're talking about the physiology of life in space, 800-989-8255. This is Jim calling from St. Louis.
Hello there, Neil. Hello,
Hi.
Folks. I'm a radio announcer in St. Louis. I'm about to go on the air, but this question has been bugging me ever since I saw a photo in Smithsonian Magazine earlier this month of the untethered spacewalk back in whatever year it was, I think 1984. How can you possibly travel at 17,000 miles an hour without some kind of major damage to your body? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
And good luck with your next announcement, Jim.
Thank you.
Lewis Staudick?
Well, you know, of course, it's not like we're traveling through our atmosphere at that speed, which would, of course, be very difficult. We're in a location where there's no atmosphere, and that 17,000 miles an hour essentially allows us to travel around the Earth in more or less a continuous free fall. So you have no perception of that speed until you look at something outside. In this case, the only thing they can look at to see how fast they're going is the Earth itself. And so you can see that you're traveling fast, but your body doesn't otherwise feel that.
We're talking about the medical aspects of life in space, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guest is Lewis Stodick, a director of BioServe Space Technology Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ron. Ron calling from Austin, Texas.
Ron, yes, hello?
Yes, you're on the air, Ron. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about the geomagnetic fields that are present on Earth. And I know that there are some common geomagnetic fields, such as the one governed by the Schumann resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about 8 hertz or so. And our bodies have adapted and evolved to accommodate these magnetic, regular magnetic frequencies. And apparently these actually disappear when we're in space. And I was wondering if that is a factor in any way, or if that's ever been noticed, or if there are any technologies that have been used to adapt for that.
Hmm.
Well, Ron, I have to admit, this is one that's outside of my area of expertise. I actually don't know much about any research that's been done there. You know, as far as I had understood, the geomagnetic fields present in low Earth orbit are pretty similar to what they are on the Earth's surface. As you might know, the space shuttle and space station are really not that far away from the planet, you know, at a couple of hundred miles. But this is one that I'm afraid I'm going to have to defer to somebody else to answer.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Ron. Let's go now to Laura. Laura calling from Brooklyn Park, Missouri. Is that it? Montana? Minnesota. Minnesota.
Minnesota.
There we go.
Good afternoon.
I'll be able to read those little letters someday soon. Go ahead.
I'm wondering what the physiological and emotional effects of being out in space would be and what exactly would cause it. I've heard some people refer to it as space dementia. Just wondering if it really does exist.
Well, there are so many changes physiologically that occur to the body. We have evolved, of course, with what we call unit gravity or Earth's gravity over quite a long period of time, and there are a number of changes that occur in our body that simply are a response to the fact that we no longer have that gravity that's part of the mechanism. You know, astronauts will lose muscle if they don't exercise vigorously. They lose bone mass often, even if they do exercise. I mentioned the blood shift that occurs very early on, and all of these things can probably contribute to different cues and different sensations that we might have in that very unusual environment. So I don't know about dementia per se, but as far as I know, the astronauts are able to work very well in that very unique environment and do things very effectively. But their bodies have to learn how to adapt to doing things differently and to traveling through the spacecraft differently and to even picking things out of the air differently and so forth.
Well, this may not relate to the space dementia, but it is on a more pugnacious note. Eileen Journey of East Hampton, Massachusetts, wanted to know, could you ever hit someone or have a fight in microgravity?
I suppose you could, but it would be very tricky because, of course, Newton's laws, every action has a reaction. And so if you were to hit somebody and you couldn't brace yourself, then you would be flying back and a lot of the force that you might try to hit somebody with would be deflected back into you, going backwards into the rear wall. So it would be very awkward, at least.
Laura, thanks very much. Let's talk. See if we squeeze in one last call. Jeffrey. Jeffrey in Persia, New York. We just have a few seconds, Jeffrey.
Okay. I was just wondering how much younger the astronauts will be than their counterparts that stayed on Earth during the trip because of their speed.
A student of Einstein.
How much will they age for this trip?
A student of Einstein. Relativity, Lewis Stodick, is this measurable?
Relatively. Well, probably not, because as you know, 17,000 miles per hour is still way below the speed of light, and so relativity probably has very little effect. Now, I suppose if you were traveling that fast for a long, long period of time, many, many years, perhaps it would be measurable, but somebody would have to do those calculations to see.
Jeffrey, good question. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Lewis Stodick.
Thanks. for having me.
Louis Stodick directs the BioServe Space Technology Center at the University of Colorado and joined us today from his office in Boulder. If you have questions or comments for us, email is the best way to reach us, totn@npr.org. Talk of the Nation is produced by Becky Villamis, Setsuko Sato, Megan Moline, John Haas, Elise Thatcher, Odette Youssef, Megan Williams, Susanna George, and Susan O'Connell. Gwen Uten directs our program. Sarah handles our production assistant. Our technical director is Kevin Waite. He gets engineering help from Vince Muse and Jerry Tennant. Talk of the Nation's theme music was composed by Greg Smith. Today's program was edited by Kyle McKinnon. Talk of the Nation's senior producer is Carlene Watson. Our executive producer is Sue Goodwin. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.